Excision number 21583, Reel 1.
Frank Moore, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Devonshire in 1924.
Which part of Devon?
East Devon, a place just outside Exeter called Clyst St Mary.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in that area?
I grew up and up to the war in that area, but I went to prep school in Salisbury and then to Wellington College in Berkshire until I joined the army when I was just 18.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did. I remember it very well. It was, I think we came back from church that day and listened to his broadcast.
At the college?
No, this was in holiday time because it was September the 3rd.
How did you feel about that? Did you have a reaction?
I think it was a little numbing, although in a way it was perhaps exciting that something was going to happen that you knew perhaps in your heart of heart was bound to happen, and one didn't know what the future was.
Did the war affect you at first?
No, at school, of course, I was head of the fire brigade at the Wellington College, and I used to go up in the holidays because I was too young to join the army right away, 1939 or 1940, and do some fire watching. And in the other respect, I was in what was then called the LDV, Local Defence Volunteers, when I was on holiday, and a friend of mine and I, we did a mounted patrol on a piece of common land on our ponies, and we used to go up and do the midday session, which was organized by the local hunt. And the idea was one of us would shadow the German parachutists when they landed, and the other would gallop away to the nearest AA telephone and ring up the local home guard, who presumably would come out with their pikes and mop the German parachutists up. But it was real sort of home, Dad's army stuff.
Did this home guard unit have a number or name?
It was the Budley Salterton home guard. And I think most of the private soldiers in the home guards were retired admirals and generals, because we knew the commanding officer who said he had quite considerable problems, because admirals or somebody something wouldn't serve in the same slit trench as General somebody because they'd had a row at the golf club.
Did you at that time think the Germans would invade?
I think we all did. This was in after 1940. We were always expecting something to happen, and it might have been a raid, or it was. But parachutists were the big cry at the time, because they had landed in Holland, of course, and they're always supposed to be dressed as nuns and that type of thing. This was the sort of rumours going round at the time. So I think everybody was expecting something, and there was very little genuine ability to defend oneself. My mother, in fact, was recruited into some sort of secret organisation that she would, if the Germans had landed, would go through the lines and pass information on to wherever the British authorities were holding out.
Did she speak to you about that?
Not till after the war. She wouldn't say anything about it. It was quite secret until shortly before her death.
What had your father done for a living?
My father, I would say, took one look at me and died. He spent most of his life in India, and he married his first wife, who died of, I was how stupid of me to forget, because my eldest half-brother inherited it, and he anyway, his first wife died, and he came back with two sons, and married my mother, who was quite a lot younger, and he died 4 years later, leaving her with two stepsons, half her age, virtually, and a baby in arms, and my sister, who was a couple of years older. So she had quite a struggle, you can imagine, although we weren't badly off financially, but it was a difficult time for her.
What had your father done in India?
He was actually in the cotton business, and he, I think he had a company which had so many cotton mills and so on, because the family had originally come from Birkenhead and Liverpool area, which was the sort of the great, where all the people went off to the east, and before that they'd come from the Isle of Man.
Coming back to the LDV, do you have were you listening to wireless at that stage?
Oh yes, we were absolutely sort of always riveted to the wireless, and you know, the news, it was the 9 o'clock or the 6 o'clock news, which was everybody listened to, and of course there were a few comedy programs.
Did you listen to VIP speeches?
Well, I can't remember that. I think when there was, I suppose, almost a ministerial broadcast, sort of, to rouse the morale of the country, I think one always tried to listen to it. My family were terribly sort of conventional at the time, and it was almost a religion that one listened to everything that was put out at the time. But in fact, before that, my mother being widowed, there was a colonel of the local artillery regiment who I think was rather keen on her, and she wasn't so keen on him, but he used to send out troops of horse artillery to do quick actions in our field, and as a small boy, seeing all these guns and horses, of course, was very exciting. This was before the war, when I was quite small, and then when I grew a little older, all the gunner subalterns seemed to hunt in the winter and play polo in the summer and get asked to all the Debs balls in the area, and so I got keener to join the army. And I left school as soon as I could. So I was going to be a regular soldier, and I was quite glad that I served in the war and decided that I didn't want to be a regular soldier. I missed two regular selection boards because we went off to war, and I couldn't really see what the army did in peacetime. We had a purpose in wartime, but peacetime, I thought, was would be a dead loss.
Did any bombs fall in your area?
Yes, there was quite a lot of bombing of Exeter Airport, which was about 2 miles away. And I remember, we had anti-aircraft shrapnel in our garden coming down and that sort of thing. I remember I think it was a Heinkel 111 coming, hedge hopping, because that's what the Germans did. They hedge hopped, dropped the bombs, and of course the airfield, it was RAF that time, were always totally surprised, I think, by that, and they went home. But I remember an old farmer out with his dog and his gun shooting rabbits, and meeting him, and he was very excited, and he said, I see the rear gunner waving his gun about. He said, I thought I'd let him have both barrels, but I thought he had more bullets than what I had. I remember him so well, that chap, and he was so excited, but frustrated that he didn't actually shoot at this German bomber with his shotgun, which would have been totally ineffective, of course, but given him a lot of pleasure.
Can you give me the details about going into the army, please?
Yes, I tried to get in a little early, before I was 18. They wouldn't have me. And I joined from school and went on a, because I wanted to be a regular, they went on a sort of hastened program. I joined the army in Scotland, at Alexandria Barracks, I think, or Alexandria, north of Glasgow. And did a spell in the ranks there. And then there was a very peculiar system that went on during the war, that they thought, somebody thought this up, that you couldn't be an officer and a gentleman unless you had been to Sandhurst or Woolwich. Now, Sandhurst or Woolwich, the military colleges, were closed during the war. And so we were sent to universities, and I went to Edinburgh University for 6 months, which in my view was a total waste of public money. We didn't actually learn very much. We played at soldiers, I think, for about a day and a half a week, and went on route marches and run marches. And we learnt a little bit about physics and heat engineering and surveying and explosives and things, not really of very much value. We lived in digs, and we were paid 8 shillings a week, out of which we had to find our lunches. So you couldn't live extravagantly up there, but I loved Edinburgh at the time. And then I went to a thing called a pre-octu, which was at Rootham in Kent, which was a hideously ghastly camp. And I think it was deliberately so, because they were trying to weed out people. In fact, quite a few of the my colleagues there who had been in the ranks, they thought it was so bad and awful that they said they wanted to return to the ranks, to units, because the camp was sort of being built. There was squalor almost. The latrine buckets were overflowing at about 7 o'clock in the morning. By about 7 o'clock in the morning, we had to go everywhere at the double with our sort of knife, fork, spoon and mug, which you then had to wash in a tin bowl, which had sometimes up to half an inch of consolidated grease on top and tepid water. And consequently, a whole lot of people got dysentery. And there were endless rackets being run by the contractors. I think we heard afterwards there were 28 firms had up in court afterwards. There were lorry loads of supplies coming in, being checked in and driving down the hill and being driven round again and coming in selling the same stuff time after time. So, I mean, when you think this was 1942, at the height of the war, the fact that there were these pretty unscrupulous people cheating the government, I thought was absolutely, well, we all thought they were rotten. We saw chaps in the woods, because it was in woods, spending virtually the day moving a ladder from one end to the other and back again, doing nothing. And so we were pretty incensed about that. And that sort of thing was often forgotten, I think, that. After this pre-octu, which lasted, if I remember rightly, 8 weeks, I went to octu at Catterick Camp, which was a relatively new barracks, but grossly overcrowded. It was built for, I think, 600, and there were 1,200 cadets. And it was pretty basic. And most of our training was, in fact, technical. We were trained to be gunners, and we learnt about the artillery work and so on. And working as in the observation posts, directing the gunfire and then on the guns and so on. There was very little what I call officer training. I remember my battery commander came, spoke to us, I think, only about once, and he said, two pieces of advice I want to give you, chaps, he said, don't try and take the ATS girls out because there's plenty of permanent staff to deal with them, and never learn to play bridge because if you play with your commanding officer, it's very bad form if you win and you can't afford to lose. And this was the only advice I ever had from battery commander on how to be an officer. But we passed out. I passed out of this OCTU in April 1943, and I had put in for airborne forces, airborne gunner. I actually was interviewed earlier by Lord Lovett, because I was perhaps keen on getting the commandos, but I found that, because I wanted to be a regular soldier, they didn't have sort of gunners in the commandos. So I put in for the airborne forces, which were, consisted then of the 1st Airborne Division, which was actually forming. It started to form in 1942, and the regiment that I joined was had been expanded from one battery to three batteries, and I literally was with them less than a fortnight when we went off to North Africa.
What was the name of the regiment?
1st Air Landing Light Regiment. It was the 1st Airborne Gunner Regiment, and we were equipped with little American-built 75mm pack howitzers, which were amazing little guns, really. We could take them to pieces and put them in the back of jeeps or all this. I mean, we normally towed them already assembled, but you could take them to pieces and strap them to tanks and that sort of thing and assemble them when you got over the obstacles. But they were very accurate, and they proved their worth tremendously, particularly in the Adarnim, where I was involved later. But that's stepping ahead. We went by convoy troop ships and landed at Oran in North Africa, in Algeria. I was a very bad sailor, on the whole. One incident, I think, I recall, was sitting on the deck, and there was an aircraft carrier behind us, quite a big aircraft carrier, and we suddenly saw it sort of tip over to one side and then right itself, and which looked astonishing, but there had been one of these long-range German bombers had come out and dropped a bomb right close to it, missed it, fortunately, but it really tipped the thing over. And, of course, we thought, good Lord, we thought they'd have spotted the bomber, but they didn't. They sent up some sea hurricanes or whatever it was afterwards. They buzzed around, of course. The German bomber had gone home by that time. So we were quite happy when we actually got through the Straits of Gibraltar to... we wouldn't have gone through the Straits of Gibraltar. That was afterwards, another trip. I went on the way to Palestine, but we landed at Oran, and we arrived, I suppose it must have been about a fortnight after the war in North Africa was finished. The 1st Army was fighting in North Africa in Tunisia and Algeria, and as far as the 1st Airborne Division was concerned, there was a parachute brigade who had been fighting there, the 1st Parachute Brigade, and the rest of the division joined them, allegedly for training. It's getting, we say, proper training, but clearly it was, as events transpired, for the invasion of Sicily, and Italy. Conditions were, when we landed, were pretty basic. We had no tentage. We had a water bottle a day, supposed to be for drinking and washing, and it was hot. It was a cold May or cold April when we left, and it was jolly hot out there, so people were, you know, we chewed pebbles or under our tongues to try and keep the thirst away. We had a sort of basic diet of bully beef and biscuits, and then we, because some Americans were there, we had American rations, which were beef and vegetable stew or beef hash, all tin stuff, which was all slightly sweet and sickly. And after about a week of this, all our men wanted to go back on bully beef and biscuits, because you know, the American food was pretty unpalatable to us when you had a lot of it. There were also some funny things that happened in that first place when we were landed, that there was an American hospital unit, and they had looked after themselves pretty well, and they were very helpful to us because they had plenty of water, they had rigged up showers, and at a certain time of the day the sky was quite full of these little spotter planes, and that was because the showers didn't have a roof on them. That's when the nurses were having their showers, and this always amused us quite a lot, because there were these chaps flying round, spotting the naked nurses where they could. This is the sort of thing that went on to entertain us. I was then detached from the regiment. I was the sort of the junior dog's body, a subaltern. And because we were an airborne unit, we had, we might say, a surplus of officers, because they reckon casualties would be high and sort of thing. And I was detached and sent to divisional headquarters as what they called assistant adjutant RA. The gunner contingent there was the CRA, who was not a brigadier, he was a full colonel called Colonel Crawford, who was a very nice chap. A adjutant RA, who I won't name because I thought he was very pompous, myself, and I was sort of dog's body. But divisional headquarters was quite interesting. We had a general at that time called General Hopkinson, who was a little man, and he was really rather brilliant because he was a glider pilot himself. He flew gliders, and I believe did the first night landing without any lights of a glider to prove that it could be done. And later on, the chap, well, he supervised the invasion of Sicily, which a certain part of the division participated. And then when we landed in Italy, which there was virtually no opposition, or very little, he went up to the leading troops and was killed, which was really a tragic thing, because he did understand airborne warfare. And when the division returned, General Urquhart, who was a very nice, very fine man, took over, but had no airborne experience until I suppose January 44, of course he didn't have the experience that Hopkinson had, which was a tragedy. But I jump ahead a little there, because while I was there, I did my parachute training, which we did in a sort of shortened version, because the parachute training that was done in England, it was done up at Ringway, and people jumped from two balloon jumps before they did their jumps from planes. We just had Dakotas, and we had our first jumps, we did a shortened course. We did 5 or 8 jumps, I can't quite remember, including a night jump to get our parachute wings. So it was quite compressed. But I remember the first time I was the number one out of the last stick, we called it, of 4 at a time. We only, in training, the first jump, you only jumped 4 people at a time, and then the plane went round again and let the next lot out. On my first jump, fortunately not in my plane, a chap got caught up with his parachute in the tailplane. And the instructors were PT sergeant, Army PT sergeant, who was super. And the PT sergeant in that plane got hold of a parachute off one of the trainees and climbed down the rigging lines to try and release this chap, and some of his rigging lines were cut and he got blown off, and he landed safely. I think he got a George Medal actually afterwards, and the rest of the trainees managed to pull this fellow back and get him back in the plane. But it was not a very nice experience, you know, because nobody sort of foresaw that could happen at the time. And in those occasions, of course, we didn't have any any reserve chutes anyway, not that they perhaps would have been much use, but you always had this feeling, would the parachute open? But it was, I was very tickled to have got my parachute wings, because it's an uncanny feeling. I always felt it was like jumping off the edge of a cliff, and because you fell about 150 feet before the parachute was open. You weren't in the air very long. Anyway, I actually found that quite an exciting experience, and the fact that I was in divisional headquarters enabled me to get on a course, which I might not have been able to get on if I'd been with the regiment. Well, Sicily came, the Sicily operation, and it's very sad. Colonel Crawford, the CRA, had said that I could come with him in his glider. And then at the last minute, he said, I'm sorry, we are overloaded. We'd be overloaded if we took somebody else. And it was just as well for me, because they landed, I believe, in a riverbed, and they were all killed. So that was my sort of first escape, if you like, from a serious accident. And then the colonel of my regiment, who was a Colonel Roddy MacLeod, was made CRA. And the second in command, who was called Sheriff Thompson, was made colonel. And there was a tremendous change and improvement in the morale. And Sheriff Thompson was a wonderful leader of men and inspirer. And from what had been rather a rabble and a lot of men on charges and so on, it turned into a wonderful regiment. Same men, just, to my view, a different leader. MacLeod was very, very able soldier and was promoted. I think he got his knighthood afterwards. But Sheriff Thompson was a real regimental soldier, and we had tremendous confidence in him. He sent us on incredibly difficult exercises all the night in the mountains in North Africa, which he called Sweat Saves Blood. We know we had SSB 1, Sweat Saves Blood 1, Sweat Saves Blood 2, Sweat Saves Blood 3, that sort of thing. And he drove us in a way, but he led us. He was wonderful. Now, This was after the Sicily operation and before the Italian landings. I was sent at that time on a course, a four-week course, on to the North African School of Artillery at a place called Chateau Dun, somewhere near Algiers, which was quite an experience for me. It was a tented camp surrounded by barbed wire out in the plain, and it suffered from thieves.